Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Natural Language Processing class for the 13th day of the semester, the 24th of September. Today we're going to finish talking about Unicode and start talking about control. I have nothing new to add to course organization, review of Unicode. For some reason, I find this so interesting that I talked way too much last time. But in any event, we talked about this table here. This is the ASCII table, which actually, as far as I can tell, goes back to how telegraph codes were organized. This was formalized in the mid-60s, and it's great for English. Not so good for any other language. So eventually, especially with the rise of the internet and the necessity to trade files all across the world, the compromise solution of Unicode was developed, and Unicode is just a giant container for all of the graphemes that anyone could possibly imagine. And like I said, it has room for 1 million, and as far as I know, only about 100,000, 120,000 are actually used. So that means it fits all of Chinese characters and Japanese characters and ancient Egyptian characters and things like that in it. And Python, since you can't really make any mistakes processing a string with Unicode, you can't make an encoding mistake because it'll ultimately get the encoding right. Python's solution to dealing with text with different writing systems is to first make sure their strings use the decode function to turn them into Unicode, and then use the encode function or method to turn them back into string objects in whatever encoding we need for the input or the output. Now, probably all of our texts are going to be in UTF-8, and in fact, this will usually be the initial step in the processing of a text, is to turn it into UTF-8 just to be on the safe side. So most of this really stuff that used to be gruesomely difficult is done behind the scenes by Python for us, and we are very thankful for that. So go ahead and open up Spider. I wanted to give you a little bit of the flavor of how to play with different text encodings in Python. So the first thing you should know, from my perspective, I don't really care, but you should know what your default, whatever you're using Python with, what its default encoding is. And the sys module has this method called getDefaultEncoding. So I suggested make up, whatever your favorite funny non-English character is, assign that to a variable, check the variable to see that it is indeed encoded in a special way, and then, in the text, I skip all the outputs, in the text I explained this better. Did anyone give this command and get a result? Mm-hmm. What result did you get?
UTF-8.
I think Spider, this current version of Spider with Anaconda is set up so that its default is UTF-8. What do you get?
UTF-8.
You get UTF-8 too? And the PCs, I know it works this way on the Mac. People with PCs?
It's CPU.
Oh, that's interesting. I remember GP1252? CP1252. Okay. You're welcome to Google that and see what it is. That's interesting. Did anyone else get something that's not UTF-8? Okay. So that's good. Yes. Windows, well, the Macs actually have their own character encoding too. So that is something to watch out for. It probably should work fine. It's probably close to UTF-8. The one problem you might have is that if you're not careful, files might get converted to that format when we're assuming that they're UTF-8. So I'm going to be super careful about that. And we will include UTF-8 conversion in all of our text processing. And so why did I want you to do this? We're going to actually, this is just to show, this is not even a Unicode string. This, to double check this, this should be a UTF-8 string right here, and I'll tell you in just a minute. And the print command, print only prints strings, and it tries to display the string as it thinks is best. But let's look at a real example. So here's the word we've been using, and I already gave it to you as a string in UTF-8. So I know that this is UTF-8. You can't necessarily look at this and tell, well, you could. Let's run through this. And so let's go. So the first step, so we've got a string, and we know it's in UTF-8. How do we know? Because I just told you. So the first step to do is the decoding part. Decoding means converting it from whatever you got it to Unicode. And so if you display that string, you'll get something that should look exactly like this. And notice it's a string with a U prefix. And that's how you know you're dealing with a Unicode string, because Python tells you. And that makes our life a whole lot simpler, because we know, again, it's hard to look at this and know what encoding it's in. This is easy to look at and know what encoding it's in. So that's another advantage of using Unicode encoding. So now we can, now that we have the string in Unicode, we can go ahead and process it. For example, we can find its length. Anyone want to guess? You remember what the word is? Spanish word, cañón. So it's linked now correctly. This is the word we started out with, that remember, it initially was evaluated as being 7 characters long, because in the UTF-8 encoding, what was happening, so it was counting, length was counting characters like this. 1, 2, 3, it's a 4-digit thing. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So given the UTF-8 encoding, which obviously Python didn't understand, it counted out what it thought were 8 characters. What's happening is that these complex codes are encoding the accented letters, right? So, yeah. It won't let you type it in?
No, it was an error. My code was blank.
Yes. Okay. Let's look at this after class. We may finish a little bit earlier. This is the problem with probably not having a default UTF. Maybe, but that shouldn't make any difference. But in any event, we'll look at it after class. So now we know we've converted our UTF string into Unicode. We've processed it. We're finished with it. Let's go ahead and share it with the rest of the world by converting it back into UTF-8 using the encode command. And if I actually probably should have shown that this, if you just ask Python what is UTF-8S1, it should give you this string back again. But instead I asked you to print it, which was probably not the right thing to do. So this, if you remember my flowchart, encoding, decode, so encoding, non-Unicode encoding, decode, processed, encode, and then share with the rest of the world. So this is in a nutshell how it works. Are there any questions about this? It puts it back, we've told the method to put it back into UTF-8. So that's what the argument does here.
So UTF-8 is going to put it into that form that I...
Okay. No, well, the encode says turn the Unicode string into UTF-8. Okay? So, I should have actually... What you can do is just type in UTF-8S1, hit return, and the result should be this string right here.
UTF-8,
yes. And I know it's in UTF-8 because I converted it myself to be triple safe. Right? So this is just how the print command does the best it can to display you, to display the string, how it thinks it should be formatted. So there's really no name for this. This is just, I guess you just call it the proper display of this string.
And so if you got
okay.
What
you mean after the print? What did you get?
I got like CA.
Yeah, the conversion didn't work right. Yeah.
So is that something I did, or is that like?
Well, let's again. You're using a PC. Mm-hmm. Maybe let's look at it after class. Okay. Yeah. Then there's was what was your default encoding? Okay. That was on the previous slide. Okay, we'll look at that.
It was the same thing as...
Okay, that was... Yeah, okay, that's not supposed to happen. See, yeah, probably, let's put at it... Okay, take your encoding. What was the name of it again?
CP1252.
I don't know whether Python will actually recognize this, but give it a try. For line 7, just replace UTF-8 with your default encoding, the CPI-252. I don't know if that's... Python may actually accept a different name for that. What?
No, it does.
Okay. And if you just type S3, capital S. Yeah, that gives you...
The original
one. Okay, let's look at that after class. Yeah, this is... You got it? And what was your default encoding? Okay. Okay, well, we'll look at it after class. This shouldn't be a problem. But okay. So let's look at one more thing. We're almost finished. So this is the same thing again, except that this is essentially the same thing, except I wanted to show processing with find all, with regular expressions, because you remember we tried to analyze this string with regular expressions and it failed. So I probably actually should have folded this into the previous slide. That would have been better. It's not, because the regular expression produces a list as its output, but we want to convert this. This has to be converted back to a string, so it can be encoded into UTF-8. Because the decode and encode are properties of strings. So if we ever have a list that needs to be, whose encoding needs to be changed, it has to be turned into a string. Oh, that was the crucial thing. Yeah, to get the regular expressions to work in Unicode, you have to add an additional argument, which actually stands for re.unicode, which just tells re to use the Unicode, its Unicode facility, so to process the string in Unicode. Okay, yes, thank you so much. Thank you so much for that question. Because if you don't add this argument, it won't work. It'll try to process it. It won't apply the Unicode processing to it, and it just won't work, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Where we start with the L.
Uh-huh.
What are we talking about?
Yes, to find the 5 alphanumeric characters in the input string. Of course, if it works right, that's all there is in the input string is 5 alphanumeric characters. The reason we're doing this is because when we tried this before on the regular UTF-8 string, it did not work. It failed miserably. Uh-huh. Okay, you know this. You notice the slight difference between line 5 and line 8. Slight difference. Line 5 is a string. Line 8 is a list that holds a single string. So this is now a list object. We want to turn it back into UTF-8, but encode and decode only work on strings. So the list has to be converted into a string with join, and so this shows us now turns the list into a string, and finally we can encode it, and I'm doing it all at once, encoding and printing. instead of separating them out, just not to make this any longer than it needs.
Yeah.
No, ask away.
So line 3 then.
Uh-huh. It's the same.
I know that's from the previous.
It's the same process. S1, the string is in UTF-8. I know it's in UTF-8 because I made it that way. So this decodes it from UTF-8 to Unicode, which is why I put the U at the front. Okay. This should be a Unicode string. So let's look at it. It starts with the U. So it is indeed a Unicode string.
So decode takes.
Yes. Okay. And encode does the opposite. Takes it from Unicode to whatever your output format is, UTF-8. Are there any other questions? Well, let's continue. Finally, we can convert between characters and their ordinal number in the Unicode extension of the ASCII table. So here's a non-English character. Here's its regular string. I guess it's in probably UTF-8. Yes. So let's decode it into Unicode, and that gives us a Unicode. Yes? Okay, well, that means it somehow converted it directly to Unicode. But, well, with the U in front?
No.
Okay. It's, unless in your encoding, that's by coincidence, is the same. I mean, it could be, this encoding could be practically be Unicode. It could be a Windows version of Unicode, right? So that it may actually give you the Unicode character sequence, escape sequence. But if it doesn't start with U, as far as Python is concerned, it's not in U. So again, we should look at this after class. Thought I had all these bugs worked out. Exactly. Yeah. So once, remember, Python has to process a character in Unicode. So once we convert this character to Unicode, we can ask what position it occupies in the big table. It happens to be position 243. Not that, you know, you particularly want to look at a table that has 243 cells in it. And vice versa, the only change with the ASCII characters is that this method has a different name. Instead of being CHR, it's UniCHR. We can, now that we know the number, we can find what character corresponds to that number. And that, again, returns us the one we started with, which it should. And so you can even do these complicated things like, so let's encode, given this string, the character that corresponds to this position, which is a string, let's encode it into UTF-8. Because right now it's sitting in Unicode, and that should, and then print the result, and that should return back the accented O, or any other weird character you played with. Yes, yes.
I understood.
Up till number 9.
What's print?
Print, it displays, I mean, it will actually print something to a printer for you, but we use it extensively to get Python to format a string and to whatever your operating system thinks that string should look like, to put it as simply as possible.
So nine
has two parts to it. We start, we choose, we want to take the character associated with position 243, which, as we just found out, should be the accented O, encode it to UTF-8. Okay, that's the first half. And once that's done, go ahead and print that character, which means to display it as best the operating system can. Sometimes it'll do what we think it should, sometimes it won't. And so this is the result. Again, the text has all this explained in flowing English prose, so you're welcome to go back and read over the text. Any other questions? The Mac people are getting approximately this answer? The Mac people plus Anna? Pardon me? And it works fine doing that?
Yeah.
Okay. That's odd that it works for you and not, because you have a VIO. Lisa has a VIO. Okay. Are there any other questions? So, that's it for Unicode. I don't really have any practice for you, just because I'm not sure it's something that everyone needs to do, forcing you to play with accented characters in languages you don't know seems kind of cruel. And in any event, this we will ultimately build in this processing, or in fact, we will use this stuff as other people's code to do this for us. So it's just to broaden your understanding about how language processing is done in Python and really on any operating system. So it's for your general knowledge. And in case you do want to use a non-English language, this should get you started. And of course, it turns out Unicode is a property of strings. And in fact, Python has two kinds of string objects, the regular string object we've been playing with for all along, plus Unicode strings. So they're actually, but the Unicode strings has all of the same properties as normal strings do. So in my original ordering of the chapters, you know, I talk about strings in chapter 1, and then we go on and on and on, and then I bring up Unicode in like chapter 7, where it's really a string thing. So I decided to divide all of this Unicode stuff up into the chapters, well, it's not actually chapter 1, it's more like 2 and 3, up into the string and the regular expression chapters. So I haven't updated it online yet, but I will probably update it this evening. So the chapter numbering is going to change. All of this Unicode text will still be there, obviously, in the table of contents of the chapters on strings and on regular expressions. In fact, I'm not changing a single word of my text. I'm just putting it in different places. And once I get all that done, I'll tell you about it on Friday, exactly where it wound up. Okay? Shall we go on to a different topic? This is much less mind-bending. This notion of control, and it's currently in Chapter 8, and again, I realize that, too, is not the exact right place, so I'm going to knock this up a chapter and also get rid of the Unicode chapter. So the chapter numbering is going to change, but I'll tell you about that on Friday. So up to now, the short computer programs we've written, you, the programmer, makes all of the decisions. Now, normally, the whole point of writing a program is for the computer to make some decisions, right? Of course, you only want it to make the decisions that you want it to make. But in any event, we need to know how to tell Python to make decisions on its own. In general, within computer programming, this process of decision-making within a program is called control. So we've got a rather long chapter now on the control constructs, which are pretty much how they work is similar from computer programming language to programming language. So every programming language has the stuff we're going to talk about. It just implements it in different ways, so it looks a little bit different. Python tries to make all its stuff short, easy to understand, and sound like English. So that's great. That's why we use Python. So the first thing we need to do, well, usually the first kind of decision you want to make is figure out in what cases does something apply, in what cases does it not apply. So these are called conditions. So something's going to, an action is going to happen under one condition, but not under a different condition. Python has, we're going to start out with something that's just super, super simple to illustrate this. Python has this lovely method, function, statement. I don't know what it really is. It's called in. And so here's a string. You're welcome to type in the string. And what do you think? How would you read this? How would you read line number 2? That works really well. Is there a Y in the string? Or capital Y? Or you could even say, is capital Y in string? And what if you type that in and hit return, what response do you get?
True.
True, yes. So this is a condition. Conditions always evaluate to true or false, at least in Python. Maybe not in the real world, but at least in Python they do. So let's just... This is so simple and so fundamental because A lot of our text processing, we're going to want to find out whether something is in something else, right? So is a certain string, is a morpheme in a word, is a word in a text? We're going to be doing that kind of thing constantly. Python gives us this super simple way of doing it. So is lowercase o in string? True. Is exclamation mark in string? And of course, I'm abbreviating the fact that these are strings. You have to obey types, so only a string can be in a string. But we'll at least for strings. Is O exclamation mark in string? Is yo exclamation mark in string? True. Notice that this is in the real world, you know, if I ask you, are your keys in your pocket? You'd say, sure. Is your pocket in your pocket? Most people would say, well, that's a stupid thing to ask. I don't know. In logic, the answer is always yes. So the whole is always part of the whole, even though in English that sounds like a bizarre thing to ask. So English is actually different from logic. Is capital Y exclamation mark in string? You should be able to answer this before you ask Python. No. Now, so we've been noticed that when I say string, you might say individually, these things are part of yo. But remember, this is a sequence. So this always has to be the exact sequence. So we're always asking about the exact sequence. Linear order of a string is always important. Okay? Is n in string? So, and finally, is question mark in string? So here's the tricky one. Is the null string in string? It's
in the string.
Yes. In logic, if you know some set theory, the null set is a part of every set. Apparently in string theory, the null string is a part of every string. Let me try to illustrate this. So I'm gonna leave off the string things. Well, okay. What's the length of this string? 3. What's the length of this string?
2.
What's the length of this string?
1.
And I keep going. Well, it seems like logically you could keep going. So you could say, well, what's the string of length 0? Well, that's actually well defined in, at least in Python string theory, that is true. A slightly different, yeah. So this works fine. That's the best way I know of explaining what the null string is. It's the string that has no content. But sometimes it will be useful. Sometimes it will be useful. So if we ever do a string processing problem and the result turns up empty, that potentially could break. It could crash the program. Well, at least here, it will be the result will exist in Python. So we can use that. We can use that if need be. Because if you get this result in your program, you can at least filter it out and say, "Oh, if I get this result, well, I'm going to ignore it because you know that means something just didn't work out right." As opposed to your program just crashing because it produced something that's just undefined. So that's a difference. And this kind of mathematical, I forget what this is called. This is the best way I know of explaining. You can also do this with sets. So if you've got a set of 3 objects, what is its cardinality? Well, that's 3. You know, you can think of these as being sets of 3 letters, 3 characters, 2 characters, 1 character. Well, what's the set of 0? What's the cardinality of the set with no members? Well, you could still imagine that it's got to be this right here, but you can't go any further. The negative ones are just, those really aren't defined. Yes?
But it does not.
Yeah, well, it's always there. Yeah, you wouldn't really want to, that's an excellent question. You wouldn't really want to say that, you know, it's sitting here at our zeroth position, because that's obviously wrong, because Y is sitting at the zeroth position. So I think if in the, it's It's actually at one of these two positions, either before the beginning or after the end, something like that. I think that probably isn't defined. So I think if you tried to get the position of the null string within one of these strings, it would give you some kind of error message, I think.
But it's true, right?
Yeah. No, but this we're saying, is the null string part of string? That's true. The null string is part of every string. Where it is a lot more difficult to answer. Yeah. It's there somewhere. It's sort of like, yes, it's like a mass that doesn't occupy any space or something like that, which can't exist, I don't think. Not a real physicist, so I don't know. But this is really a mathematical construct. It's not a physical construct, you know, a real world construct. It's just there's a blank right here that we can fill in. We can fill in this blank. If you were to keep on going, we can't fill them in. We have no idea of what that might mean. Okay, shall we keep on going?
Oh gosh.
Lists behave just like strings. So here's a list. Notice I don't call it list because list is a Python method. So you can ask yourself, is apple in list? And we would hope that this evaluates to true. Yes. Is peach in list? How should this evaluate? False. How about this? Is app in list? Is it true? The lawyer. Okay. Yes. For searching lists within, if it's a list of strings, the string searched for has to match exactly. It can't match apart. But we'll see in just a minute how to get this result. We just can't do it in one step. Is the null string in list? What do you think? Is it? Yes, we've got a yes.
Oh, I'm guessing.
It evaluates to false. If you want to, so remember with line number 4, we saw that the string has to match. The search for string has to match exactly. If you actually added the null string to the list and then tried to find it, it would actually work. Because in that sense, this is a list of strings. And if you add the null string to it, Python thinks the null string is a string just like any other string. So you could conceivably look for it. And see, always adding the null string could conceivably give you a trigger to do something. If you needed one. We won't see that kind of complication. But this is just I just want you to know of the existence of this null string thing, because every once in a while, just so if you ever get it as a response, you'll understand what's going on. And of course, we've already seen that the null list exists too. So there's a null list that exists too. I think we've seen it. Okay, any questions about this? So in works pretty much the way you'd expect it to from English, except that the whole is part of the whole, and you could conceivably, and at least with respect to strings, the null string is part of every string. But what I didn't think is to look for the null list. Yeah. Someone check to see if this is, you know, if how this gets evaluated. Does the null list, is that part of the list?
False.
That's false. Okay, so here lists and strings are a little bit different. I guess the null string really is a special kind of thing. Okay. Python lets you be amazingly concise in how to state these things. What do you think about this? How should this evaluate? Assuming the same list as before. How would we read this? How would we read this in something like normal English? Okay, it's easier to conceptualize if you break it down into two questions. So imagine putting parentheses around this. So Did I put it here? No. Here? No. Oh, it's here in my hand. Okay, so what I've got. Apple, put that in parentheses. And then the result of that is we're going to ask whether the result of that is in list. That evaluates, it's really more like this, which you can't really read. So if this evaluates to true, then you get to check whether this also evaluates to true. I'm sorry, it doesn't actually work like sequentially. Is app an apple? If that's true, okay, is apple in list? Now I explain this. So the first, reading from left to right, the first statement gets evaluated. And then you can continue reading from left to right and evaluate the second statement. So what happens if the first statement is false? What's the result? The whole thing's false, right? So pretty much Python hangs up right here and says, I don't care what the rest of it's like if I start out false. Try it the other way around. What if the second half is false? Because remember, peach is not in the list. Is P in peach? Sure. Is peach in list? No. So both of these get evaluated to false. I continue. One last topic. Well, not even a topic. How about this? Oh, not in and string. Where did I get string from? And why did I call it string? I shouldn't have done that. Okay. What was our string? Yo. But I didn't define it as string. What name did I give it? String. I did give it string? Oh, that's bad. It's a potential module. Shoot. So the string is yo. Is in the string? No. So how would we read the? I mean, in normal English, so is in not in string? True. That should evaluate as true. Now notice, this is the logical way. This is how this would be said in logic. In logic, this would be something like using the not sign and in string. So if you're familiar with logical notation, and of course in arithmetic, not is sort of equivalent to the minus sign. So this is how this would work in logic or arithmetic. Of course, that doesn't sound like English, so Python actually allows you to restate this as if it were English. With it, the not looks like it's sort of modifying the preposition. So in not in string, that's true too.
So essentially,
it's better. You're asking, you don't know, so you're trying to find out if this is true or false. So in that sense, it's like asking the question. But we don't normally ask questions like that. Isn't not in string? True or false? Isn't not in string?
True.
True. Yes, it evaluates to true. It may be easier to say, is it not the case that, in string? I don't know.
It's like saying N
yes.
True is not in string.
Yes. It's you're asking about the truth of the negative of the statement. So is it true that this does not exist? That kind of thing. No, and we don't. There's something about the formation of questions in English that we don't form them naturally in terms of negation. How about capital Y and not in string? That should be false. Capital Y exclamation mark not in string. True. Yo, not in string. Null string, not in string. Should be false, right? If the affirmative version were, if the positive version is true, well, the negative version should be false. And now we'll change to list. Apple, not in list. Should be false. Peach, not in list. Should be true. App, not in list. True. Null string, not in list. That should be true, too, because it's not there. We can do concatenations. P, not in peach, not in list. Is P in peach? No. Is peach in list? No. So the whole thing should be true. So conjoined negative conditions always have to, everything has to evaluate to true to continue processing. Right. And finally, P not in peach, not in list. P not in apple, not in list. Both of these should be false, right? Because P is in peach. So this is false because P is in peach. And this one turns out to be false because apple is indeed not in the list. No, peach is not in the list. So this is true. P is not in apple. That's
apple isn't.
Apple is in the list. P is truly in peach, but peach is falsely not in list. Yeah, so you get the reverse. Both of them still wind up being false, right? But for the reverse reason. And that's it. Any questions about this? Next time we'll continue talking about control. Next time there's lots of other fun things to talk about. Once we finish this chapter, we will pretty much be finished with the programming part. So the next topic is to actually collect text. So we'll be about a third of the way through the semester and we'll be finished with just nuts and bolts programming. This has to do with how your operating system thinks this stuff should be encoded and displayed. I'm sure there's a way, we should be able to deal with it directly with Python. In fact, using this as the encoding should be the solution.
Once you post the slides, I'll go back through them.
Yeah, please do. I would love to know.
And I'll let you know.
If you find, I mean, I really need to know
what happens,
if you can find a solution.
Okay.
Because Python, I mean, this stuff, this is the way to do it. This is the approach to it, so it should work. The only thing I don't know is whether Python actually recognizes this as an encoding. That could be the problem. That there's an alternate name for
so
this.
So, like, when I did that, you brought up, like, the XF3.
Yeah.
So